Do not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Be the Media. This is CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. On this show, we talk about all things media, from the local to the global, including perspectives of consumers and producers of media. All contributors of Be the Media are faculty, students, and friends of the Media Studies Department and Media Research Lab at Vancouver Island University. I'm Marianne Vanderzon with Neil Scobie and Joy Googler here in the studio. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Today we have a live interview with our very own Neil Scobie. We'll be focusing on an audio piece that he produced in 2010 on Marshall McLuhan. It's a fabulous audio piece, and I've been really looking forward to this interview for a long time, including the airing of the piece as well. So we're going to start with that. Then we're going to have a review of the book The Artful Edit from Joy Googler. And we'll finish the show today with Robin Davies' Further Excerpts from an Oral Machine. And that particular segment is called My Headphones, They Saved My Life. I do want to mention that you are welcome to get involved in the show at any time, and you can do so by phoning 740-1017. I'd also like to let you know that the show is podcast, and you can pick up the podcast at your leisure. Simply go to chly.ca, go to the podcasts, and you'll find Be the Media in the list. We've got a great show ahead. And let's jump in.
You say, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Fat Five Freddy told me everybody slide. DJ spinning, I said, my. Flash is fast, flash is cool. Francois, c'est pas, flash ain't all due.
You say, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Welcome back to Be the Media. I have today with us Neil Scobie. Neil Scobie's with us a lot. Why? Because Neil Scobie is also a co-host of this show, a co-producer of this show, a co-technician of this show, a contributor of this show of Be the Media. He's also a student at VIU, majoring in digital media studies. Neil Scobie has an extensive history in the music industry. He spent 17 to 18 years in the industry, first as a DJ, then as a recording engineer and a producer. Neil also was involved in two works that he produced that had Juno nominations. One was in 2002. It had a Juno nomination for Hip Hop Single of the Year. One was in 2003, and that was a Hip Hop Album of the Year. Neil, it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us today. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Marianne. It's a pleasure to be here.
Once again, you're kind of on the other side of the mic this time around.
Yeah.
How does that feel for you?
It's a little unusual, actually.
Fair enough. Let's start just by chatting about your background a little bit, because
sure.
it's interesting and it's extensive. What was your time in the music industry like? You were there for 17, 18 years.
Yeah, I started out as a DJ. In the 80s, I was fascinated with hip-hop, to this day. But what was the most fascinating to me was the musical element of it, and I wanted to be a DJ, and that led to, you know, messing around in my bedroom with turntables, as most DJs get started, and that led to DJing in clubs, which led to, I also did radio on CITR EBC back in 1989 to 91, and then that gradually progressed to doing recording engineering and then producing. All the way up until about 2 years ago when I moved back to the island.
And why did you leave the industry?
It was a mixture of reasons, most of them family related. The industry, it had served me well for a long time, and it just kind of felt right to leave. I haven't completely left. I'm just not in it as a full-time gig at the moment while I pursue my education at VIU. So I do intend on returning to it at some point, but right now I'm just taking a break.
And I'm curious, so you're now doing the digital media studies program at VIU.
Yes.
Do you find your focus shifting away from audio into other areas, or is it still ensconced in that area, or how's that progress? How's that journey?
I would say that it's given me the ability to pursue interests that I had, but was maybe unable to do. I mean, in my life, I could only balance so many things from being in the industry to also being, you know, a parent and a husband. And there were times when I was in Vancouver that I did want to pursue different elements of media production, be it film or video. But audio was my background. It was what I was the most strongest in. And it was really, it's like Jack White of the White Stripes. His analogy was, the White Stripes was just the one band that took off, but he was in five. And for me, audio was the thing that really took off for me. So I pursued it and stuck with it.
Right. Fair enough. It's interesting. What was the experience like? You were nominated for a couple of Junos on two works that you produced. Can you tell us a little bit about that, a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. As a hip-hop DJ and producer, what I did was I would make music at home and then shop it to different MCs or rappers that I knew. It was a collaborative process that really started separately. And this is common in the hip-hop industry. You create your music on your own, and then you shop your music out to different MCs that want to work with you. And what I did was I made what's called a beat tape, and it was an actual tape of different, you know, 30 to 60 second long instrumentals, and I gave them away to different MCs that I knew in Vancouver. This particular rapper's name was Checkmate, and the song was called Raw, and it also featured an artist from Detroit named Royce the 5'9", who he had ghost written for Dr. Dre. This song went on to be nominated for Rap Single of the Year in 2002, which is probably one of the high points for me in my musical career. I mean, we didn't win, but I mean, just to be nominated was great. I know it's cliche, mm-hmm. but it's really true.
Yeah, well, it gives credit and recognition to all the hard work that goes into it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely. And no doubt it certainly doesn't harm the CV either, right?
No.
Moving forward in the industry.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. let's look at the piece. Let's talk a little bit about the piece that we're going to air today.
Okay.
So just to explain, what is this piece? Why did you produce this piece?
It was an assignment. It started as an assignment in digital audio class at BIU. It was fairly wide open, the assignment, which is very liberating. It can be constricting at times if you're not really sure where to start. But for me, because, you know, I love audio and I have that background, I knew right away what I wanted to do. Because I have this background in hip-hop, what... If I could just back up a little bit, what I find so fascinating about hip-hop music and its history is its ability to, or its unique ability to take a piece of music and turn it on its side and use it in a way that it wasn't originally intended by the composer, the original composer. And I say the word original loosely because I mean, that's a whole other conversation, which we could get into, but... hip-hop, whether it's a piece of music or a technology or a fashion style, hip-hop from its inception has been about taking something and using it in a different way. Like the turntable, like before we came into the interview, we started with Grandmaster Flash, The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel. And I chose that piece because it's from 1982, but it best replicates what hip-hop was in the beginning, where they would take different elements of records and mix them together and make their own sort of collage. And that's, as it pertains to my piece, it's a collage of vocal snippets of Marshall McLuhan juxtaposed with different sample drum sounds and synthesizers. And it's basically a collage. And that's where I feel is my strong point when I'm making music. I like taking bits and pieces and making something new out of them.
Right. So, okay, so you mentioned it, folks, is on Marshall McLuhan. I'd like to invite Joy Googler into the conversation at this point as well. Welcome, Joy.
Hi.
Why Marshall McLuhan? Why did you choose to focus on Marshall McLuhan?
Well, since coming to VIU and being in the Digital Media Studies program, I had heard of Marshall McLuhan before, but I have to say that I didn't know a lot about him other than the little vignette that's played on CBC from time to time where it's an actor portraying Marshall, and he says his famous line, the medium is the message. Yes, we got it. Well, what does that mean, Professor? Such and such. That's all I knew.
Heritage Minutes.
Yeah, Heritage Minutes, exactly. In reading one of his books, The Medium is the Massage, there were two lines, five pages apart, that really, really struck with me. I brought them with me because I knew I'd forget them. All media is an extension of human faculty, and the electric circuit is an extension of the central nervous system. And for me, working in an electric medium and music being an extension of man, my argument was there's sort of a stigma to this day around electronic music that it's not like real music. And I'm, for those that can't see me, I'm doing air quotes around the word real. But to me, music isn't about chops. It's about emotion. And Marion, I'm sure, because you were speaking about this yesterday, you've been to jam sessions that don't quite work out. Somebody could be a virtuoso on an instrument, but if there's no response from the audience, then to me, it loses its point. Whereas you could have somebody that's playing with a drum machine or something that is, it's not a traditional instrument, but if it is creating emotion from the audience, then that is much more important than virtuosity on a traditional instrument. Mm-hmm. It's about emotion for me.
Yeah, I would agree. For me, it's about that connection. Right? And,
yeah.
And there's communication there.
Yes.
Certainly, whether it's between musicians or from musicians to audience and back and forth. And that's the magic of music, is that ability to communicate.
Yes.
And or call it emotion, right? I think we're talking about the same things and using different language.
And it works across medium, too. It works for writers who are, when they read their works aloud or they get responses from readers, and you know you've touched a nerve, you've found somebody out there in the darkness who's reached back and grabbed your hand. That's a pretty rewarding experience for writer, for editor, for publisher. And it's why we do it, because, you know, as many starving artists will tell you, it's not for the money.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to jump back. Did you finish your thought, Neil? I didn't want to cut that off.
I just wanted to add that a large part of the musical piece does involve sampling. And sampling, I believe, is still largely misunderstood. People associate it with, you know, like with, that you're stealing an idea or you're stealing a, you know, a piece of somebody else's work. There was a filmmaker, Kuleshov, who he was one of the first, if not the first, filmmaker to juxtapose scenes to what would seemingly be arbitrarily juxtaposed scenes to create like an emotion from the viewer. And what sampling does is the same thing, except, you know, except it's oral, AU, orally. So when you take two sounds that from two completely different sources and mash them together and create a new sound, it creates that same effect. And going back to the listener and creating emotion, it creates a new emotion that was not there to begin with. Yeah. So I really would argue the point about, you know, stealing, because what you're doing is you're actually creating something new. Mm-hmm. And I don't think any sound or, any song is completely original anyway. You know, if you want to say that you own a song, okay, well, in our country or, you know, or in the United States, there are copyright laws that allow that. But what I find ridiculous is you didn't build that instrument. You didn't create the diatonic scale. You didn't create 4/4 time. You probably got a lot of the ideas from influences before you.
Whether or not you knew it.
So I would argue that nothing is 100% completely original anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting discussion where we could segue into copyright and law, and I don't want to do that on this show, but I will let listeners know that I do want to set up a panel and talk about copyright, because it's a really interesting debate.
Yeah, and it's changing in the digital realm.
Very much, very much. So you were talking about Marshall McLuhan, and you gave us the quotes from Marshall McLuhan that struck you and that spoke to you. I'd just like to step back and actually turn to you, Joy, and ask you if you can just give us just a very brief minute or two overview of McLuhan. Who was he? Why is he important? Because a lot of our listeners out there might not know.
Well, he was a writer who profoundly changed the whole sort of theoretical landscape of how we talk about media, I think, particularly in the 50s and 60s when we were seeing advertising have a lot of influence, and the arrival of television and discussions around whether it would replace radio, and a sense of like what was happening to us as we were watching more and more television, and is that a dangerous thing? And we turn to academics to explain this to us, like we turn to doctors to explain symptoms. And he, instead of saying, you know, all of this is bad for you, he said, let's just step back and look at it a little bit more analytically and think about, you know, it in terms of a power balance. You know, is it a two-way street or a one-way street? And he talked in particular about a kind of hypodermic model of advertising and of media, where it went one way and somebody just plunged the plunger in the needle and you ingested it and you didn't necessarily process it. But that's not what he was encouraging, of course. That would give the producers of that media too much power. So he was trying to give us the building blocks to break it down, analyze it, and decide, you know, how it would affect us and realize when we were being manipulated. And I think now most media listeners are so much more savvy at a much younger age, not only because of the volume and variety of media, but because of media studies classes and ways in which things get analyzed all the time while they're happening. So even though many other theorists have gone on to talk about media and all the different ways that it has played out in the 21st century, everyone goes back to Marshall as a founding father, mm-hmm. I guess, as a way of looking at how we interact with what we see and what we hear and how it affects us, as Neil says, in our nervous system, so we, you know, right down to biology, but certainly to the psychology of it and why it's so effective or ineffective, and how we can use media against itself, which I think is really interesting and is part of that remix culture that Neil was talking about. We can sort it out and turn the different tiles of the Rubik's Cube and make something totally unique out of it. And writers do that, obviously, with words and letters, borrowing on phrases and influences that they've and whole written approaches that they've used, to musicians and painters, and we all do it. It's the rise of postmodernism, and even though that came after McLuhan's influence, it's still, you can go back to him and find a quote in almost any essay, if students are listening, to find something that justifies their argument.
Right. Well, thank you. It's a beautiful overview, and it's a great segue into Neil's piece. Neil, before we play your piece, is there anything else you'd like to say?
I just wanted to really work with the wordplay. The different excerpts of Marshall McLuhan speaking are from a whole series of different interviews, and I really wanted to use the words in a different context than he originally intended, and that was sort of the whole point of my piece.
Great. Here we go. Neil Scobie.
All media are extensions of some human faculty, mental or physical. The wheel is an extension of the foot. The book is an extension of the eye. Clothing is an extension of the skin.
Electric circuitry is an extension of the central nervous system. Electric circuitry is an extension of the central nervous system. The extension of any one sense displaces the other senses and alters the way we think, the way we see the world, and ourselves. When these changes are made, men change. Men change. Men change.
My next guest has been called many things, most of them flattering. He's a professor of English literature and poetry at the University of Toronto. He's written several very influential books. He coined the phrase, the medium is the message. Would you welcome, please, a prophet of the electronic revolution, Mr. Marshall McLuhan. A prophet of the electronic revolution, Mr. Marshall McLuhan. A prophet of the electronic revolution, Mr. Marshall McLuhan. Mr. Marshall McLuhan.
Literate culture is visual and detached. It creates the civilized man, the detribalized man, the man who is not involved. And the effect of the electric revolution is to create once more an involvement that is total.
Mr. Marshall McLuhan. Mr. Marshall McLuhan. Mr. Marshall McLuhan. He coined the phrase, the medium is the message.
Why should art and culture suddenly become very big business, like big science? The reasons are tied up with the fact that that we're living in an information age. When you live in an information age, culture becomes big business, education becomes big business, and the cultural explosion or the information explosion becomes itself culture. It knocks down all the walls between culture and business.
Speaking freely today is Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan.
He coined the phrase, the medium is the message.
Marshall McLuhan.
The artist is the only person who picks his antennae, pick up these messages before anybody. And so he is always thought of as being way ahead of his time because he lives in the present. There are very many reasons why most people prefer to live in the age just behind them. It's safer. To live right on the shooting line, right on the frontier of change and so on, is terrifying.
Whether it's an electric light or radio or telephone or TV, each of these media creates a new environment. It creates a new situation for human association and human perception. Any medium at all creates a new pattern, a new atmosphere, a new environment of human perception, which works upon the whole map. It works upon the whole society. That is the effect of the medium, has that total pervasive effect. That is the message. Social change that is brought about. The content of the medium is never the message, because the content is always the old medium. The content of the medium is never the message, because the content is always the old medium. The content of the medium is never the message, because the content is always the old medium. The message to the medium is never the content, because the content is always the old message. The message to the medium is never the content, because the content is always the old message. The message to the medium is never the content, because the content is always the old message. The message to the medium is never the content, because the content is always the old message.
This machine an irresistible, uniform, repetitive machine. And the turning of society into a great, irresistible, repeatable, irresistible machine was a startling innovation, an irresistible innovation thing. It was considered a radical machine. This machine, an irresistible, uniform, repetitive machine. And the turning of society into a great, irresistible, repeatable, irresistible machine was a startling innovation, an irresistible innovation thing. It was considered a radical thing. The circuit as an instrument is an irresistible, uniform, repetitive, startling sequence machine. A startling innovation, an irresistible innovation thing. A radical sequence thing. Where would you look for the message in an electric light? The medium and the message are the same.
And welcome back. Welcome back to Be the Media. That was a piece from Neil Scobie. Neil, I wonder if you could come back to us and tell us a little bit about the process of making that piece.
I started with several pieces of him speaking, whether it's in an interview or a lecture or whatnot. There's another element where it's actually not even his voice, it's something else, somebody reading a passage from his book. But like I was saying before, because I come from like a hip-hop background, I wanted to take his voice and change it in a way not originally intended, just like a lot of the music that I'm using in the background, sampled drums, and various samples used in ways not originally intended by, you know, the original composer. So it's really just a mixture, a mishmash of sounds and him speaking and me chopping up his words. And it's really how I work when just making music in general. And it kind of ties together the whole electricity being an extension of man's central nervous system, because without electricity, none of it would be possible. And hip hop's one of the first types of music that would be completely impossible without electricity.
Yeah, true enough. It's a fabulous piece.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for sharing and talking about it. We're going to move forward. It's certainly a conversation that we could continue throughout the show, but we have other exciting and fabulous things coming up. We're going to move forward now to Joy Googler, and she's going to give a review of The Artful Edit. And before we go there, I just want to remind you that we're listening to CHLY 101.7 in Nanaimo. This is Pat Higgins, Right On.
Right On by Pat Higgins, and this is Books and Bites on January 20th, 2011. I'm your host, Joy Googler, and you're listening to CHLY's Be the Media. Today on the show, we're discussing a dirty little secret many media students, in fact, citizens of every stripe, might harbor, but few confess, the desire to write a book. Some may even have gotten as far as putting pen to paper or fingers to keyboard and bashing out several dozen or hundred pages, now stashed illicitly in a top drawer and revisited in moments of renewed fervor or after a bad day at the office. But what happens between drawer and bookshelf? How does the would-be author ready the book for press and edit it into submission? Susan Bell has the answer in her new title, The Artful Edit, on the practice of editing yourself. Bell has edited fiction and nonfiction for Random House and other publishers in New York for the last 20 years, and now teaches at the New School and the Tin House Writers Workshop. She's got some excellent advice for frustrated scribes whose genius hasn't yet seen the light of day. And this review reveals she's an eloquent storyteller herself. So tune in, listen up, take notes. The editor is in the building. After the sweating bullets task of identifying a novel idea, researching it, and willing yourself through discipline and bribery to actually write a manuscript, there comes that fabled practice at a hushed remove from the glamour of writing itself, the edit. As an editor of Canadian fiction for the last 20 years, I can tell you our type are well practiced in defending what we do, a much maligned act, and even more misunderstood. But like a mother dragging a child to the salon for a haircut, we insist it's necessary and probably will make you look better. Bell says most writers hold the idea that editing is penance for the fun of writing, or they see editing as a hydra sprouting two new heads for every one that's slain. The trance of writing is far more agreeable to them than the sustained glare of the edit. But if you think about the true nature, not the myth, of writing, you'll find that editing is, in some ways, the easy part. While we write into a void, we edit into a universe, however ravaged it may be. And being somewhere is less lonely and frightening than being nowhere. So forget for a minute the intoxication of invention and honor the cold splash relief of revision. Bell employs these and other metaphors to try to describe the slippery art of what an editor does, and in so doing practices what she preaches, showing rather than telling, and writing what she knows. She encourages writers to learn to calibrate editing's singular blend of mechanics and magic. For if writing builds the house, nothing but revision will complete it. One writer needs two carpenters, a builder with metal and a finisher with slow hands. Raising the work is probably not necessary, but selective rebuilding will be. When editors read your draft, they look for the walls still left blank at the end of turning corridors, where you may place an arrow, as it were, to get your reader to make the turn. Bell's own voice in this slim but perfectly measured work is assured, inventive, and rife with beautifully turned phrases, to remind writers she loves language and its powers as much as they do. Besides, editing is a conversation, not a monologue. She says we are loath to put an objective ear to our subjective selves, but to edit is to listen, above all, to hear past the emotional filters that distort the sound of our all-too-human words, and then to make choices rather than judgments. The manuscript must be tossed into the editor's sieve until the chunky parts of speech are removed and the fine, smooth powder of an idea remains. That said, editing is as much an improvisation as a science, dependent on the content and the personality of its creator. It will take careful and tactful negotiation to get through the four-month editing exercise, given that a writer generates anxiety as a lamp does heat. Many writers fear the edit because they fear their own doubts about the work are in fact warranted. This is especially true of the first-time writer, who hasn't yet been given proof of his talent. Under the veteran's feet is the floor of accomplishment, whereas the novice is walking on air. If a good professional edit pisses us off, it's usually because we're angry at ourselves, not at our editor, for stopping short on our own before collapsing into another's editorial arms. It is easy to imagine that a writer, unmoored, will grab on to his editor's views as a tired swimmer to a raft. The author-editor relationship requires the editor to be part therapist, part parent, part cheerleader, part gardener. For as Bell says, the editor tends her author as a gardener does her plants. Some are cacti, some orchids, but all get their requisite water. An editor's attention goes a long way to soothe and motivate a writer, whose life can, in periods, smack of solitary confinement. But to be the greatest assistance to the writer, an editor must want to find the story, to see potential in its telling. An editor reads to discover a new voice, a fresh sound in the ear, an as yet unmapped route to a particular emotion or thought. surprise is the editor's drug of choice. When she edits, she sees a manuscript through a split lens. Through one half, what is really there. Through the other, what could be. The bifocal mind is a wishful mind and skews the work's potential for greatness into greatness itself. The editor reads the first draft as if she were the ideal reader, without pencil in hand and in one sitting. For the writer, the first draft takes a long time because it's like the teeth of a zipper. Each one has to be right to stay on track. But for the editor, this first read is the fastest. The second time through, she reads as an intrepid explorer, trying to traverse the narrative terrain like a map, searching for topographical imbalances. The first substantive edit is primarily an assessment of structure and tone. Bell describes them this way. Structure is the design that underpins your prose. It is your narrative fence. Without it, your words scamper about like unruly flock of sheep, impossible to follow. Text is a plastic art, not a verbal one. It has shape. Tone is to story what atmosphere is to a room. When the literary ballet has suddenly become an infomercial, there has been a change in tone. The second edit is a line edit, and at this stage, the editor presumes that the car has a chassis, four wheels, and a working engine, but may still benefit from tuning, lubrication, and a paint job, and if required, some optional extras. The line edit addresses language, style, and voice. It determines the transcendent aspect of a writer's work, that unique style that for a painter emerges in the palette and stroke, and for a writer in the lexicon and syntax. Certain words have good posture, others shrug. Unlike a personal trainer, an editor is there to diminish the narrative sags. This edit also looks at beginnings and endings. For Bell, a fine beginning often poses a question, or many. But even if it doesn't, it presses the reader, perhaps with the lightest of touches, further into the story. It does this with wit, verbal texture, a syntactic sachet, a vivid setting, an ominous mood, a surprising image, a deeply rooted voice, an offhandedness that says you've entered the middle of the story that began long before you came, or all of the above. What a fine beginning never does is succumb to verbal litter. Likewise, a work ends with a startling mix of style, philosophy, and itch, the itch that can only be scratched by moving on. And then finally the third edit, or copy edit, checks your spelling, punctuation, grammar, assures everyone that not a word is out of order. This can be said of the artful edit itself, a magnificent teaching tool and reference for anyone who writes for business or pleasure, in the classroom or in secret. I'd highly recommend it for authors who need a book whisperer with a seductive voice. In the coming weeks on Be the Media, we'll hear from a panel of writers and journalists who will speak about the writing process. But until then, we'll give the last word to, of course, an author. Nabokov had this to say to his editor. You've done a magnificent job. While reading your script, I felt like a patient reclining under the glitter of delicate instruments. I'm still under the spell of your Novocaine, and hastily return to these pages before I start aching. For Books and Bytes, I'm Joy Googler, aching to get my hands on the next book.
Music is The Hollies, Right On. Thank you very much to Joy Googler for the latest review on the artful edit. Next up, we have Robin Davies with further excerpts from an oral machine.
You are listening to Be the Media on CHLY 101.7 FM.
We are pleased to present further excerpts from the oral machine.
We are getting around to the idea of noticing that we have a total environment which is necessarily acoustic.
And in her ears, the thimble radios tamped tight.
Hi there, faithful ears. You are listening to further excerpts from the Oral Machine. Oral, the new machine that everyone wants, collapses time and space, you see, so the ear can now be coupled with sound waves from the other side of the world, from the past, and perhaps the future. The most efficient way for the sound waves to travel from the machine into your ears is via a set of headphones. Placing tiny speakers, such as earbuds, right next to your eardrum, or even just on the outside of your ear, such as the large headphones mentioned last time, means the outside world has much less chance of acoustically interfering with the oral machine's content. Unless we want to try bypassing the basilar membrane entirely, sending electrical signals directly down some nerve ending to the brain, this kind of hardware solution is our best bet. Some headphones are better than others. Avoid the really cheap ones they try to sell you on the plane, particularly if they have those silly plugs for proprietary airline hardware. The headphones Apple provides with its iPods are a little better, the earbuds which first appeared in the 80s and 90s. However, earbuds don't keep the outside world out, and the actual speaker which transmits the sound is pretty small, making it hard to faithfully reproduce lower frequencies, the bottom which keeps the dancers from hiding. I am a fan of circumoral headphones, the ones which cover and surround your ear entirely, as opposed to pressing on your ear. These headphones allow the external part of your ear to core out the sound waves, meaning the audio which makes its way inside has been realistically filtered. Anyways, I wanted to share a few tracks which are related to the headphone experience, both in title and content. This one's by Bjork, the aptly titled, Headphones.
Genius to fall asleep to your tape last night. So on. Sounds go through the muscles. These abstract wordless movements. Move, 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 move. They start.
Here's a track by Kinky called The Headphonist.
like this anymore. To hit the streets without a cord. Now the city is my song where I submerge myself, taking a long walk around the block. Every little step, every single step becomes a note that I draw on the staff lines of the sidewalk. I'm walking alone again, with my headphones on again. And I really want to run, but at this moment I'm listening to a very, very quiet song.
I'm walking alone again, with my headphones on. And now I speak and I am screaming, because I can't hear my own voice. I'm walking alone again, with my headphones on. I have to walk between smog, behind sunglasses, inside my clothes. Sometimes I feel that every simple thing has a sound. And if it does, what kind of shape does the silence have?
Even if the silence still with me,
everything I see has a sound. And if it does, what is the shape of silence?
Sparkling new, a pocket size, a white one, a small one.
One that is on your arm as a tattoo, or a waving flag on the back of your car,
as an umbrella to protect you against the rain of noise that the city has.
Or maybe it's just a small envelope with a secret inside.
I have one more headphone theme track to share, called Headphone Silence by Ayn Brun.
I'm traveling the wonderful loneliness of the headphone silence. Feels like no one can see me. They see right through me. Cuts me off from the rest of the world. They're useless strangers sharing my time and space. They might hear my humming, my tapping of fingers anyway. At least I have my thoughts all to myself. My contentness and the view outside. I see a rainbow complete, resting its feet on the hill and the ground. Works as an illustration to the sound. This is a hole in time, a couple of hours when the day is more abstract than usually. I star in this movie, I play the part and unify. Soundtrack.
Whenever I find myself needing a new pair of headphones, I bring along a favorite tune I know well when I go shopping. If you know the material well, you can better appreciate the way it has been reproduced. My headphone testing track is by an English duo called Orbital. The track is called "The Girl with the Sun in Her Head." Incidentally, Orbital recorded this one entirely with solar power.
Thank you.
and welcome back to Be the Media. It's been a great show today. Many thanks to all of our contributors today on Be the Media, Robin Davies, Joy Googler, especially Neil Scobie, and I'm Marian Vanderzon. You're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Be the Media is brought to you by the Media Studies Department and the Media Research Lab at VIU.
How does that grab you?